Accession number 29079, reel number 2.
I think the experience of the First World War was that it was a double-edged weapon, because sometimes gas was released because the wind was in a favourable direction, and then the wind turned around and you got your own gas back again. So anyway, I don't know what the upper echelons thought about the possibility of gas, but as you probably heard, everybody had to carry a respirator. The other thing I did was I ran basic rifle training. So everybody, the group captain was very keen on this, everybody in the station had to learn how to use a rifle. So if there had, although it was unlikely then, but if there was any invasion or parachutes dropping, everybody could fire. So that was one of my duties. And the other thing was I ran, particularly with the pilots, how to put up barbed wire, because the expectation was that once we landed in Europe, that sort of aerodromes or runways might be set up quickly, and it would be necessary to give it, that runway, some protection with barbed wire, and everybody had to learn to shoot on the ground.
Was there any particular method of putting up barbed wire that was...
No, I can't remember the details now, but you obviously had to have three coils of it, two on the ground and one on top of the other, through.
While you were stationed there, were you in much contact with the civilian population or the local population?
Only at the local pub.
Were you encouraged not to mix or...?
No, there was nothing like that. It was pretty sparse. I mean, Curtin Lindsay was only a small village.
For how long were you stationed there until...
Well, now comes the unfortunate thing. People can hardly believe it, but in the middle of July, I was taking part in some sports event, long jumping, landed very badly and broke my right femur. So that was in the middle of July 42. I was whipped off to the Scunthorpe War Memorial Hospital, where I stayed for about a week, 2 weeks, and then sent to Harlow Wood Hospital. This was an isolation hospital near Mansfield, which had been turned into a general army hospital. There were all sorts of chaps there recovering from wounds or other mishaps like mine, and I stayed there till nearly Christmas 1942. I was again extremely lucky in that when there was a surgeon who was well known at the time called Pulvertaff, he was a brilliant chap on orthopedics, and he decided that it was not necessary for me to have anything else except what was called a Thomas splint. The leg was pulled straight and all the bits and pieces fell into place. So as it healed, there was no shortening of the limb. So came Christmas time, 42, I was discharged fit, and I was still grade A, fit for duty.
Did you have to regain your fitness?
Oh, yes. I kept myself fairly fit in bed. One did exercise as much as possible. And then once I was able to walk, I did walking. And then when I got rid of the temporary support splint, I started up running again. And so I used to go for a run twice a day. Got myself pretty fit.
Could you talk a little bit about the general mood concerning the progress of the war at this stage, both your own and those of your fellow soldiers?
Oh, I think there was a bit of depression because we'd lost Singapore, and the events elsewhere in the world, we lost Burma and all these other places. Fortunately, the North African campaign was going better, so there was some sense, well, as Churchill said, something about this may not be the beginning, but it's the something about it's the beginning of the bad time. Oh, no, the end of the bad times. And of course, there was as you know, the general reaction to all the bombing, etc. I don't think that at that time people were getting really fed up with it. Their resistance was still 100%. I have heard that since, that towards the last year or two of the war, there was a bit of increasing depression about the final outcome.
Did you have concerns for your family?
Oh, yes. There'd been... my mother and father were still living at Clapham, and there'd been a lot of bombing there, etc. I remember on the occasional leaves, in particular going to using the underground to one of the Clapham stations, and if I was arriving late at night, having to wend my way through all the people sleeping on the platforms.
After you left the Harlow Hospital, you rejoined the Sherwood Foresters?
I went to a training unit for, I think again it was at Lincoln Barracks, and then after a month I think I was there in early 1943, I was sent to the 1st Battalion of the Foresters. They were at Great Yarmouth. I was still in the infantry. During that time, I'd been promoted to lieutenant. After 18 months, every second lieutenant was promoted. And I stayed there till April 1943. And then I was asked, I was told I was going to be posted overseas. Did I want to go to the East African Forces or the West African Forces? Well, I wasn't a very brave bloke, so I thought, well, West Africa is further away than anything, so I chose West Africa. So I was shipped off to joined the Royal West African Frontier Force. And
how much knowledge did you have of where you were going?
Very little. If anything, I just knew I was going to West Africa.
Could you describe the voyage out?
Yes, it was... we went out from Bristol on a boat called the Highland Princess. It was one of the fleet of ships which had been carrying meat, chilled meat from Argentina. And the troops, there were British NCOs and other chaps on board this boat. They were accommodated on the mess decks, and we officers were lucky to have be crowded into a cabin. I think there were six in mine, but it was a cabin. That took, I think, about 3 weeks to get there. We called in at Freetown, where some chaps were got off, and then the boat continued to Lagos, and there we were all sorted out, and I was told I was joining the 6th Nigeria Regiment. They were based at Ibadan. They'd just come down from Kano in the north. And they'd come down to start jungle training, because the intention was, once it's part of the 81st West African Division, and the intention was to get the troops and everybody trained up, fully equipped, etc., and then to be sent to India.
Could you talk a little bit about how the jungle training took place?
Well, it was like living... The Africans, of course, were well used to living in the bush, as they called it. Most of them were from the north, where there wasn't much jungle. In fact, it was desert country. They were mainly Hausa men, Muslims, but we did have a few sprinkling of Christians and others. Some of them were, what do you call them, agnostic. They had no religion. And they had to get used to marching in the jungle, living in the jungle. We spent many a night, sometimes on marches, spending as much as a whole week out and learning how to bivouac, etc., which of course came in useful for when we got to India and Burma. We were then with the Wingate Special Forces, but more about that in a moment.
How did you find the jungle and the climate in Africa?
Oh, it was pretty hot and pretty damp, particularly during the rainy season. But one soon got used to it. I mean, we were young. I was only 20 or 20, something like that.
Was your issue kit any different to what you'd been given in Britain?
Well, only from the point of view of we wore tropical dress during the day, shorts. You had to wear socks and long putties. And then at night time, everybody had to wear long trousers. But the equipment, rifles and everything else was normal.
Was there any concern or provision made for dealing with insects
Oh, yes, one had to. We started taking Mepocrine tablets as a protection against malaria, one tablet a day. and we'd kept that on for a long time, 3 years. So eventually, of course, we all had yellow skins. And you had to learn to button up, etc., so that the exposed skin was as little as possible at night. And whilst we were in barracks, everybody slept under mosquito nets. The barracks at Ibadan our battalion was fortunate because it had been the permanent barracks of the 1st Battalion, the Nigeria Regiment. So the troops were in, they weren't in the huts, there were long lines of barrack rooms. And the officers were based in houses from the Public Works Department, but they'd taken the houses over. And there was a permanent mess which had been used by the PWD officers, and that became our army mess.
What did you eat?
Oh, normal food, except at weekends we always had the treat of a so-called ground-up stew, which was kind of a stew made of ground nuts and similar to a curry.
But otherwise, it was British rations, or was it geared more towards the
African? Well, British rations for us, and then of course the rations for the troops consisted of their local foods. I can't remember. It wasn't maize, but sweet potatoes, and of course there was a lot of fruit around. I mean, that was so cheap.
While in the jungle, were you expected to live off, or able to live off the land, as it were, or
no?
Were you self-sufficient with rations?
Because there was nothing there. Although later on, when we were in Burma, we had to live off what food we could get. But I'll come to that later.
Could you talk a little bit about the relationship you had with the Nigerian soldiers in comparison to that with your previous British commands?
Oh, they were pretty good. And the discipline was quite high. They had all volunteered, most of them, to join the army, and they were happy to get their army pay. I can't remember how much it was. It wasn't very much, but at least it was better than what they had been getting. There were a number of regular, some of the senior NCOs had been part of the pre-war Nigeria regiment. So the discipline was generally made by the NCOs and the lines. There was always trouble. They were inclined, some of them, to sell off their socks or things like that. And it was rather funny. If a chap had lost part of his issue or was late back in barracks or had gone absent without leave for a couple of days to see one of his wives or something, he was put under what the army called a 252, which was a form stating his so-called disregard for army regulations. And generally one said, right, have you lost your socks? Yes, sir. Right. Half a crown fine, 7 days confined to barracks, or seven for arse. And inevitably, they would all say, seven for arse, sir. The sergeant major or sergeant, take him outside and whack him. So he used to get whacked and come in and say, thank you, sir. And you tore up the 252. That was the end of the incident. But somehow news got back to Britain. If a question was raised in Parliament, and this is quite true, that British officers were authorising the beating of troops in West Africa, physical punishment, and this had to stop. So orders came down from divisionary headquarters that the awarding of physical beating was to stop. So after that, the chap would come in, did you do this? Were you late in parade? Yes. Okay, half a crown fine or 7 days CB. Inevitably, the chap would say, please, sir, seven for us. I say, he couldn't give it. And that was one form, one way of maintaining discipline, and it worked.
Did you and the other British officers have a good relationship with the Nigerian soldiers?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We were, at that time, we were very welcome, because we were able to dispense money.
And what about language issues?
The main language was English, but we all had to learn, because we had Hausa men, to speak Hausa. And also, some of the troops were French-speaking. So I soon got adept at giving out orders in English, Hausa, and French. I'd learnt French at school, it came in useful.
Did you have to make any special provision for religious considerations?
Oh, yes. The troops were, most of them were Muslim being, and so one had to be a bit careful on Fridays, let them have some time off for prayers. But we had got some dispensation from the Emir of Katsina, who was one of the highest ranking persons in the Muslim world, and because of the needs of the war, some of the religious restrictions or practices were relaxed, but no pork was ever served to the troops. When they got meat, it was meat, not pork, until we were in Burma.
What contact did you have with the civilian population?
Not that much. Well, we were busy training, etc. We used to go at Saturday night. There was the Europeans who had lived in Nigeria on various, you know, either working for the government or on commercial organisations. There was a European club. And so we did meet quite, which all Europeans were entitled to use, including, strange to say there, that the NCOs, the British NCOs. So we were all allowed to use the club. So we used to meet a few of the non-army people there, but nothing, and not in any great numbers, as far as I can recall.
Did you get a chance to see much of Nigeria as a country?
No.
What contact did you have with home?
With
home?
Only by letters.
Were you not able to have parcels or aid packages or anything?
I can't remember. I didn't have any because they didn't ask for any.